Stephen Bassett joins us up next, head of the Paradigm Research Group. Latest work, U.S. Presidents and UFOs, The Untold Story. We will talk about disclosure. Stephen has been speaking on tour in Europe. We'll find out their reaction over there to UFOs and disclosure as well. Up next, Stephen Bassett on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen Bassett, Executive Director of the Paradigm Research Group and a very top leading advocate for ending the government-imposed truth embargo regarding extraterrestrial presence in the human race. He is a political activist, lobbyist, commentator, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Stephen, how are you?
I'm fine, George. It's great to be back with you.
Traveling. You're all over the place. Europe. You finally came back. Are you back in the States now?
Yeah. I returned on the 20th from Paris after touring Europe for about 40 days.
You getting any rest? You're still working around the clock these days, Stephen.
I'm trying to get caught up. There's so much going on, so much happening that it is going to take me a couple more days to get it squared away, and then I'm off to some more speaking.
Well, lots to talk with you about tonight for the next couple hours. Stephen, what's the perception in Europe toward disclosure and toward UFOs?
First of all, exopolitics, which you've talked about on the show, is growing over there. The interest in it is growing over there right now faster than it is in the U.S. And it's appealing to a much younger audience. It's quite striking. The reason I made the decision to put together a speaking tour of Europe followed my involvement in the Exopolitics European Summit, which was held in Sitges, Spain, back in July. I think it was July 26-7.
That came up after your ex-conference, right?
Yeah, it was a couple months after the ex-conference.
Yeah. Okay.
It was put on by the administrator of Exopolitics Spain website, Pepón Holver, and his business partner, Miguel Salates. And they put on a Exopolitics summit at a four-star hotel near on the coast, just south of Barcelona, with a 1,200-seat auditorium, first-class auditorium, at 1,300 attendants. Average age was like around 35.
Interesting.
Media coverage, consecutive translation. This was very impressive, and I realized that Europe is where we're going to see exopolitics expand the most over the next few months, and so I wanted to get back and not only help that along, but also get a sense of how Europeans are feeling about this. And it was clear that the interest is growing, and there's less. I think, how can I put it? The truth embargo was primarily practiced in the U.S. It was fundamentally practiced here, not so much in Europe. The emphasis on containing the issue, ghettoizing the issue, as I like to say, ridiculing it and what have you, in order to contain it since 47, was primarily here. And so there's a little less resistance in Europe. So I'm feeling that, and the enthusiasm, the energy that I'm getting from the audiences, not only in Sitges, Spain, but my events, was extremely impressive. And when you couple that with the actions of some of these governments, George, such as the United Kingdom and France, mm-hmm. Denmark, Sweden, that are releasing thousands of UFO files, the pressure on Europe being placed on the United States government to take some action here, to finally end this embargo, is growing very quickly, and it's going to play an important role.
Why do you think the Europeans, whether they're just governments or even their population, why do you think they seem to be more receptive to either UFO disclosure or information than over here?
Well, there is a receptivity here. But over in Europe, it's a younger crowd. The Generation X, as we call them, are really taking this issue on. And as I said before, if I think that the actual practice of the truth embargo was primarily conducted in the U.S. and not so much in Europe. Generally, Europe just went along with the U.S. on this issue. And so they didn't really worry too much about pumping propaganda out over there to get people's minds right, as it were. But as this thing has unfolded since the end of the Cold War, the young Europeans are getting hold of this issue now. They're starting to get the information, and they're really getting into it. You know, it's funny. I learned recently that this term, Generation X,
yeah,
which was applied to the sons and daughters of the baby boomers, of which I'm one, right?
Me too.
Was Art, and Art and many, many other of your guests are Generation X. I mean, baby boomers.
Boomers.
Yeah. But this term was arbitrarily applied by, I think, some sociologist who wrote a book about that generation. Just picked that, right? There wasn't any clever connection.
Yeah.
And so I decided that, well, okay, from now on, the reason we call them Generation X is because I believe the sons and the daughters of the baby boomers are going to be instrumental in not only closing the deal on disclosure, but also really impacting the post-disclosure world. So as far as I'm concerned, that's why we call them Generation X.
Stephen, I had David Wilcock on the show a few weeks ago, and he came up with one of the most incredible statements I've heard in a while. And he said that he's been told through his sources that President Obama will make disclosure internationally, flanked by extraterrestrials on each side. And I said, David, come on, this is too much for me to handle here. And he strongly insists that's going to happen. Have you heard anything like that?
Have I personally heard? No, I have not. But I'm obviously following all of this with considerable interest. There's really two stories going on here. First of all, this begins, this current speculation regarding disclosure begins with an interview by Project Camelot of a gentleman by the name of Pete Peterson. That interview is available online. Obviously, Project Camelot is Bill Ryan and Carrie Cassidy. Pete Peterson is apparently a PhD, made the statement in this interview that disclosure was going to take place later in the year. And he actually picked a date. I think it was November 20. And that date was based on the fact that his sources had told him that TV time had actually been selected to, quote, make an announcement, disclosure, essentially.
Huh.
Now, I've talked to Bill about Peterson. I said, look, how strongly do you feel about him? What are his credentials? I don't know him. And I don't have a full understanding of just who this fellow is. He's also referring to his inside sources. So this issue begins there. Then David comes on your show, and he expands on it. And he adds to it, well, I guess he has some spice to the stew. And he has his sources, and he ends up getting a BT. All right. And then, of course, that gets picked up. And that's the kind of thing that can work around the Internet pretty fast. And eventually I'm getting emails to me saying that I'm predicting, right, that disclosure is going to take place on a particular date in November. Of course, I'm not doing that.
No.
I have indicated that the window has been very wide open since the election, and that 2009 was absolutely the best opportunity we have had since Roswell itself, frankly, and that if we act and keep the pressure on, we can help make this happen. But it's still, there are many things going on out there, particularly this financial mess, that could put this off. But still, that's my sense. 2009 could still be the year, and also that if the U.S. doesn't act, there's a growing likelihood another nation might act. And so on the one hand, we have this developing story where people are, you know, have their sources claiming that something's going to happen. And then we have the interest in it. And I'm noticing that the interest in disclosure is growing. The expectation is growing. And so if somebody puts something out like that, it really takes off and goes through the net pretty quickly. So I'm impressed by that. Is it going to happen in November? I do not know. Could it? Yes. This is a very complex chess game that's been going on, George, for a very long time.
True. But they make a mistake, Stephen, when they pick dates and the dates come and go. It kills their credibility, and it makes your job harder, doesn't it?
Well, you know, on the one hand, first of all, you can have a source can give you information that can simply be wrong, and then you repeat it, and you're wrong, too. So on the one hand, yeah, there is a negative when you do that. On the other hand, it does reflect the growing enthusiasm and expectation for this to take place, and I consider that a positive. Look, this is a very complex chess game. Let me just give you another perspective on this,
sure,
to get an idea how complicated this is. One of the problems that the government has, say our government has, with disclosure, is that this is not something they can throw up a trial balloon first or leak some stuff out and see how it's going to play. They can't do that because it could generate a huge media frenzy and just make it a mess. And so if they're going to have a disclosure event, they want it to be absolutely clean, meaning, you know, the day before, nobody has the slightest idea this is going to happen. The next day, there it is. Yet they still have the risk of a leak. Now, how do you inoculate yourself against a leak? Say you wanted to do it on a December the 8th, for instance, just picking a date.
Okay.
December the 8th. Well, if a story were to come out, say, in early November that this thing is in the works and it's going to happen at a certain time, and it comes out in our world, you know, the world where this issue plays out, which is not the New York Times, as you understand, and that issue gets out there and in play, the mainstream media doesn't deal with it. They sort of throw it off. Then if another leak, a real one, comes out, from a real effort, an effort to effectuate a disclosure event, the press is more likely to ignore it, even more powerfully than once the, quote, predicted date is passed, and any leak after that, then going into the real event, would be completely dismissed. So this is this would be, I'm just speculating here, a way to inoculate the government that's trying to avoid leaks, creating a mess, leading into a disclosure event. Do I know that? I do not know that. Look, this is a very heavy thing. It is extremely complicated. There is so much going on. Everybody is wanting this to happen. Everybody has got their ear to the ground. And so they're picking up messages, they're getting contacts, whatever, and this thing is out there. So I think that is the important message, that the interest and expectation for disclosure by our government is very high right now. And there may be some false alarms, but I wouldn't get too down on that.
Okay.
And I try to keep, you know, an open perspective.
Should this disclosure come from the United Nations level as opposed to some individual country?
Well, yeah, that's another point. You know, that part of the story trajectory expands after David Wilcox, because then Michael Sallow writes an article for the Examiner in which he draws on the Peterson interview, draws on Wilcox's statements on your show. He then brings in a couple other things, including the story trajectory regarding the UN, as you know, the fact that meetings were very likely held there. And this has to do with a source we call Source A, and he initially approached the Pickering, Clay Pickering, in New York. Now, and he brought that into the mix, right? So, again, providing more, you know, depth. So he writes that article, and that continues things forward. All right, fine. The UN issue, I looked into a little bit, and I talked with Clay, and I actually talked with Source A on the phone, tried to arrange a meeting. Now, he seemed credible to me. Several of my colleagues, including Sala, I believe also Bruce McAfee, possibly one other, actually met with Source A. And he presented his credentials as an officer and what have you, and they seemed to be suitably impressed with that. The sense I get is those meetings did take place. Now, what this source's role was and why he brought it out through Clay Pickering, why he chose to speak out at all to, quote, reveal these UN meetings, I do not know. But I sense that those, at least one of those meetings did take place. Now, to get to your question, yes. You would think that the UN would be the absolute logical entity to effectuate disclosure as quote, a global organization. The problem is that the UN was created as a Cold War organization, designed to be a way to deal with the Cold War issues, which is why the Security Council was set up with a limited number of states with full veto power. And what happened was that after the Cold War ended, they did not restructure the UN. It is still the same Cold War structure.
Right.
And that has not been helpful. And also the UN has been diminished into means substantially by the U.S. as well as underfunded since the end of the Cold War. And so the UN, unfortunately, is not in a good position to play this role. And, you know, I think that is regrettable.
The United States seems to be at the front of this and also at the front of holding back on a lot of information. As you said earlier, you know, the UK is releasing, Brazil is releasing, French is releasing. We know what Paul Hellyer did in Canada. Why do we keep holding back here in this country, Steve?
Well, my assessment is simple, that the U.S. was the leader of this embargo. The truth embargo was initiated by the U.S. with the cooperation of its World War II allies. And this is going all the way back to 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52. And you can understand why they went along with us at that time. We've discussed this before. Obviously, the U.S. was held in extremely high regard. The U.S. was critical in defeating the Axis powers. Everyone knew that the U.S. was the only nation capable of countering the Soviet expansionism and the nuclear threat posed by the Soviet Union that we were well aware of by 1947. And of course, it all came about. And so when they agreed to go along with this, I don't think there's anything surprising about that. And so this embargo was led by us. And so what is happening is that after the Cold War ended, there was, an immediate expectation on the part of these other nations that, okay, the Cold War is over. That was the principal reason why the embargo had to be in place. The national security interest in our country felt that bringing the ET issue into play formally while these missiles were pointed at each other on hair trigger notice was simply too risky, and they weren't going to do it. And I don't want to argue with them on that. But the Cold War ended, and these other nations were thinking, okay, now we're going to get on with this, because this is a pretty big deal. There's a lot at stake here, and there's a lot of benefits if we can get this issue moving forward. But the U.S. didn't act, and that's a whole other show. I mean, we can go on for hours about that.
Yeah.
But we did not act, and so their impatience grew, and that's why you saw the French issue you saw that non-governmental, quote, governmental report, the Cometa report issued by the French, that French organization, Cometa, in 2000 or late 1999, came to light in 2000, and then you saw the release of documents by these other countries with France and Britain and Australia and Canada and Denmark and Sweden, Brazil, Uruguay, but not the U.S. Because, you see, the release of documents by these countries is really a message to the U.S. It's not like, oh, they just feel like clearing out their UFO files right now. They don't want to take this issue out from under us. There's nobody yet prepared to preempt the U.S. on this. But so they're sending messages by saying, hey, look, we're opening up the files. We're moving on with this. When are you going to act? Of course, the U.S., being the leader of the embargo, is not doing anything. Because if the U.S. were to do what the U.K. is doing, start releasing files, given the awareness of the public on this issue, George, that, you know, which is largely in part due to Coast to Coast AM for the last years, sure, that they started releasing files like that, it would generate huge media interest and embargo would be gone. And so the U.S. is basically holding fast until the day that it ends the embargo. That's the model that I'm using. I think it's fairly accurate.
All right, Stephen, we're going to come back with more with you in just a moment. Stephen's websites are all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll also get his take on Lonnie Zamora's death, the incredible story of the New Mexico police officer who reported a UFO sighting in Socorro, New Mexico in 1964, one of the greatest documented cases ever. Just want to get Stephen's take on that. And in the final hour, we'll take phone calls with Stephen Bassett right here on Coast to Coast AM. With our guest tonight, Stephen Bassett, ex-conference and Paradigm Research Group. We'll be back with him. We'll talk a little bit more about his trip to Europe and how the Europeans are reacting to UFO disclosure, and much more on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We've got Stephen Bassett here. Stephen, I want to get your reaction to the Lonnie Zamora case. You remember that from Socorro, New Mexico, 1964. We just found out today that he died a few days ago. What an incredible story that was when he and his patrol car spotted an egg-shaped UFO with occupants outside. J. Allen Hynek had once said it was one of his best cases he's ever tried to document and investigate. Incredible story.
Sure. There have been many, many particularly well-known cases. That's one of them. What it tells me when I hear this, and we hear it a lot now, the truth embargo goes all the way back to 47. That's when the UFO era began. That's when the truth embargo began, essentially. So we're now 62 years in, and not surprisingly, as time has passed, many of the witnesses, researchers in this field are starting to die. And we're losing them now at a steady rate. Lonnie Zamora, of course, just recently, but just a few weeks back, we lost one of the deans of UFO research, Richard Hall, goes all the way back to the days of NICAP, 50 years in the field, and he passed. We have lost...
Young guy, Mel Tony's just died.
There's been some untimely deaths, like Mac Tony's and Paul Vigay.
Yeah.
These are young fellows. And, of course, that's really tragic. And we've lost, you know, John Mack. There's just so many. And I actually, every year at the X Conference, I have a little section devoted to the people that have left us. But what it's telling us is that this issue now is virtually lasted almost a lifespan. And we're going to lose a lot of the witnesses and a lot of the researchers. And that's just another reason why we need to get this done. This is history. And what's the problem here is that, well, I mean, obviously everybody's going to die, but the problem is that without disclosure, without the full engagement of this issue by all of our institutions, the press, the universities, research organizations, what have you, we're losing history here. And so we can get disclosure done while these people are alive. They can be interviewed. Their work can be brought forward. They're there to present this history to the world. Obviously, they can't do that if they pass. So that's just one more reason. So when we lose someone like Lonnie or John Mack, it's just another reminder that there's a huge history that resides in the lives of thousands and thousands of researchers and witnesses that is not being properly vetted because this embargo is in place.
Did they talk much about the Rendlesham case out there in Europe?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's their Roswell.
Yeah,
and it was brought sort of back to life again recently when in one of the UK UFO files releases they brought out some more documents on Rendlesham. And there's a talk about a reunion maybe taking place. I'm considering the possibility of trying to bring in as many of the Rendlesham principals and researchers as possible to the X conference to really put emphasis on it. Don't know if that's going to be possible or not, but. Oh, yeah. I mean, naturally, it happened in Europe. There's a lot of interest in Europe. Look, I went to 19 cities in 10 countries. There were formal conferences in a number of these cities, which included Berlin, Orivesi, Finland, Holst, Netherlands, Liverpool, England. There were special events actually put together for my passing through in Paris. Credits in England, Rennes, France, in Switzerland, and Oslo, Norway. And the turnout was roughly 100, 120, that type of thing. We had almost 320 in Paris. I was also able to get on Danish national television and Danish national radio. That's their equivalent to their BBC. Their equivalent to the BBC. And got really good reception there, and that's up on the internet now. It was a very impressive sense of the interest across many countries in this subject. And, of course, the Exopolitics World Network, which I started back in March of 2008, is now up to 23 countries. We've added several recently, Poland, Czech Republic, Mauritius, I'm leaving one out, the Netherlands. And I anticipate a number of other countries coming on. And so the sense of a disclosure movement is really coming on. And again, it's under the umbrella of exopolitics. As you know, George, there's a lot of controversy out there about exopolitics. There's a lot of resistance on the part of particularly, I guess you call the old guard ufologists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're concerned about it and how it's going to affect this issue and their work. And I understand that. But Let me try to put this in perspective for your audience. And I'm going to have to blow my own horn here just for a second, but I'm doing it for a reason to make a point.
Well, you're also entitled because you've been in this battle for years now, Steve. So go ahead.
Yeah, 13. And I'll tell you, it's starting to wear a little thin. You know, it's turning my hair gray, George. After the X conference last April, 16 through 19, we held a press conference at the National Press Club. And it was at that time that Edgar Mitchell, after Edgar Mitchell, he called on the administration to disclose. Milton Torres, that retired Air Force major who was ordered to shoot.
He was great. He was great at your conference.
He was. And he called on the administration to disclose. And then I went in front of the camera, and we were live streamed by CNN. And I said, you know, President Obama, there's two reasons you need to disclose. And that is, one, if you don't do it soon, this embargo is going to be your embargo. And if you don't, there's a good chance another nation is going to do it. And this enormous legacy is going to be lost. And the next day, PRG's work was extensively covered in an article in the Washington Post and in the Washington Times. Prominent articles in the Times, Washington Times was in the political section.
Which is unheard of in the old days. Unheard of in the old days.
Very unusual. And then just 24 days later, PRG's work was featured in the New York Times online. Now, and the emphasis there was on the energy. And and these articles are mentioning truth embargo, they're mentioning disclosure, exopolitics. Now, look, there were a few tongue-in-cheek remarks in these articles. Nothing too much, but, you know, there's sort of an understanding here that as we played this game out. You have to throw a little of that in. But the point is, those articles were pretty good, and they had all the right names and the right issues and the right language and so forth. And that's just in 24 days. Then, as I pointed out on the tour, I was able to do it, you know, Denver, you know, National Radio, Denver National Television. And then the work of PRG is going to be a prominent part of an article coming out probably this January in the Atlantic Monthly. And very likely there's going to be a very substantial article devoted to PRG's work in exopolitics in the Washington Monthly.
Super.
So that's substantial. I mean, that is non-trivial. And I think the point here is what has happened with exopolitics is this. This field, this umbrella concept, where we have a term to describe the socio-political engagement of this issue, not just the science of it, not just ufology, has made it possible to reach a broader audience. Politics is a huge part of media coverage. Everybody knows that, right? My God, I mean, politics is in the news constantly. And, you know, there are a lot of people out there, they haven't the slightest idea what quantum mechanics is, and they don't know about relativity, and they don't know how saucers fly, but they know, they understand politics, and they know, and they're interested in that. And so by engaging this issue from a political perspective, we have opened it up to a much broader audience, and we've added a way for the press to engage it that is more consonant with, you know, the way they normally cover stuff. And so exopolitics is going to be and it will be the vehicle that sort of gets us to the end of the game here. And to add to that, we reached a milestone just a couple of days ago. You know, when you search on terms in Google or Yahoo, you get page returns, right?
Yeah.
And if you put the term exopolitics into the Yahoo search box, keeping in mind that exopolitics has only one use in the language. I mean, it's the UFO ET context. There is no other context for this word. I mean, you can put some words in that search box and you get 20 million pages back. That's because those words have multiple contexts, multiple usage, not exopolitics. And so when you put that in Yahoo, you get 880,000 page returns for exopolitics. But we hit a milestone because in the Google search, I come to understand that based on how Google does their thing, that you don't get a proper return unless you put in exopolitic without the S. You put the S in, you limit the returns. So if you put exopolitic into the Google search box, you get 1.1 million page returns. So it's kind of a milestone. We finally passed a million. This gives you a sense of how how broad this is getting, how fast it's growing. And so that's the message I want to give to people. We're not trying to usurp anybody's previous work. We're not trying to take over. We're trying to find a context that can broaden this to a much larger audience, not only nationally but internationally, bring the media into it, not just about, you know, the science of saucers or the forensic analysis of a particular event, but the political implications of this, of the reality of these ETs and their presence here, the government truth embargo, the government actions, postures, the social implications. This allows for a much broader media context, and I believe we are succeeding. I think the evidence is there.
What drives you, Stephen Bassett? Because, as you said, 13 years, and you haven't given up.
Yeah, George, the issue is compelling, obviously, on its face. And I wanted to get into something meaningful. And I made that a willful decision in 1995 that I was going to do that. And this issue had been in my back of my mind for a long time. I looked into it, decided this was where I wanted to go. People make those choices all the time. I was a political activist at heart, and I was finally able to bring that activist out in me, and that was fine. And I found a niche. I found an issue and an approach to things that really worked for me, and I was very happy, and I was able to really get involved. What I didn't expect and what surprised me is I got involved in the issue. I began to understand its implications on the United States, mm-hmm. on America. What it told about what has happened in the U.S. since 1947, particularly since the 60s. And it really relates to some of the most important issues of our time. It also has significant global geopolitical implications. And so the deeper you get into it, the more you see what's at stake. And so at some point, you just give yourself over to it and say, look, we cannot continue to go forward with a lie of this magnitude sitting there unresolved. That lie, in fact, that misrepresentation, that embargo, is also reflective of a larger concern, which surrounds what I call the secret empire and the massive increase of this huge intelligence arena and the secrecy and covert programs and so forth that have developed, particularly in the U.S., that I think now pose a threat to the Republic. At some point, you realize that this is huge, and it's bigger than you. It's bigger than all of your colleagues, but you know it needs to be resolved, and you pursue it to try to achieve that end. So it's kind of an intellectual passion, but it's also grounded in my concern for my country and also the concern for the planet. So I'm a political activist like any other. People are pursuing environmental issues with great passion. Mm-hmm. There's still issues of race in this country and so forth and so forth. So it's like that.
If and when disclosure comes, how do you think they'll tell us? I mean, how will they even start this announcement?
Well, I'll tell you. If I was advising the president, which I'm not, I would hold it late on a Friday, about 7 o'clock, after the market's closed, after the news is closed for the day. And so you'd have 2 days before the market's open on Monday, and I'd do it between Thanksgiving and Christmas, right? This is kind of the time when people...
Slow news day, no news
slow
period.
Slow news, you know, things are a little calmed down, people are a little distracted.
Yep.
And again, it would have to be done quickly. They can't be a lead-in. There can't be trial balloons put up. And as I've described a few times before, some on your show, I would ask for some time for the president from the Oval Office, a couple of minutes. And I wouldn't tell the media what it was about, which would get their attention, but they'd give you that time. And then the president would go on, and he would say something to the effect that very important information was going to be presented to the American people this evening, and that he wanted to know two things. That one, he fully authorized the release of this information, and that the American people should not be concerned, right? But yet should pay very close attention. And then, I think at some point they would alert the media that we now want this to go to a press conference and set up Or there'd be something set up at that point, and that it would shift to a press conference held somewhere, maybe the National Science Foundation, NASA, wherever.
So you think there would be questions as opposed to just a presidential statement?
I think the president would be smart if they did not. He didn't do it. I think the actual statement should come from a neutral person, a nonpartisan person.
Maybe a scientist or something, somebody like that?
Exactly. And so they would cut to a press conference. It was all set up, ready to go. And it would be the moderator of that press conference that would make the announcement. And that person would say, we are here today to address and answer questions about this issue, namely that there is an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. We could not reveal this formally to you prior to this for national security reasons, but we are going to do so today. We're going to give you some information today, but we're limited. Various reasons, and there would be a panel of maybe 15 or so high-level individuals from various aspects of our society, and each one of them would present a few minutes of their thoughts on this issue, and then they would take, questions from the press. And if I had to pick a moderator, right, just to be that person, the person that would actually make the announcement to the American people from this press conference, someone who was respected, nonpartisan, nonpolitical, I'd pick Michio Kaku. That's who I'd have moderating that press conference.
Would you have picked Sagan had he been alive?
Yeah, I think I would, though there's a complex history there. But he was one of the great popularizers of science. And and Michio Kaku is kind of the Carl Sagan of our time.
Yeah, I think so.
In some way. So, that's how I would do it. And then they would take some questions from the press that would go on for a bit. And then there would be a statement that, more information will be coming out later, but this is what we can do tonight, and that would be that.
They try to calm people that there's no threat, don't panic. They'd have to say that.
I think the president would say something like that going in.
Yeah.
What can I say, George? I think there's no other way to go. If they're going to come in and say there is a threat and you have to panic, then
it's over.
It would be tough, but I'm telling you, they don't have a choice. Look, whatever the situation is, they have got to get down to the truth on this. They cannot continue to play out this embargo. There are too many other nations, and there are four in particular now: France, Russia, China, and I'm going to include Brazil because Brazil continues to advance on this issue. Very much thanks to the work of A.J. Gavard, who's doing a fantastic job down there. But the Brazilian Air Force has just made some additional announcements. A previous member of the Department of Defense, Defense Minister, has made some extraordinary statements recently. Brazil is a nation which is coming on very strong. They have one of the strongest dollars currencies in the world. They're taking measures to send to the world stage. They recently got the 2016 Olympics. Brazil could be that nation. And so one of these nations is undisclosed. So whatever the situation is, they had better get down to the truth business. Now, I don't blame them for trying to do what they can to maintain as much calm as possible as we get into this. Perfectly understandable. I happen to believe, I don't think there is a real fundamental threat that we should be extremely worried about. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be paying real close attention, and we shouldn't be prepared to hear some things which might be disturbing. But whatever the situation, they simply can't keep it from us any longer. They need to unburden themselves. Whatever there is they're carrying on their shoulders, they've carried it long enough. Now they need to pass that burden on to the rest of us, the other 6.2 billion people, and let us carry that burden along with them.
We're going to be back with phone calls with Stephen Bassett next on Coast to Coast AM.